So, this particular so-called mini-seminar on Nietzsche and perspectivism is going to be very Nietzsche indeed. It's just going to have 2 weeks. And my thought about how to divide our attention over these 2 minutes was today to talk some about what I call the dialectic of perspectivism and how to situate Nietzsche's early writings with respect to that dialectic. And then next time to talk about the middle and the later Nietzsche and why I think he is interested on this topic. But so in that sense, today will mostly be stage setting for next time. But hopefully, stage setting of some interest. My plan is to just talk. I'm not sure how many of you have had a chance to read the article I made available carefully, so I'll talk around it. But since some of what I'll say will be a version of things in it, it's arguably the case that our time will be just as well spent by your interrupting me and asking me questions and taking me off in directions where I might not go if you didn't do that. So I'm going to talk to fill the time productively. But you should feel free to stop me at any point. I welcome your interruptions. I thought I'd start maybe with... I made this handout before. I was exactly sure how I was going to use it. I thought it actually started with something that's towards the end of the internet. Namely, item 15 on the handout. This is a quotation from Arthur Danto in what was, when I was a young man, a famous book about Nietzsche. It's called Nietzsche's Philosophy. So when I was young, in the 60s, early 70s, and so forth, if you ask people for a clear and sensible book that would help explain Nietzsche's philosophy, they might recommend Dante's book to you. At some point in the book, Danto reaches the point where he wants to explain what he takes to be pretty much Nietzsche's central doctrine, which he calls perspectivism. And the book has been very influential in causing many other people to write books in which they now tell us what Nietzsche's perspectivism is. And this is how he explains it. This is what happens when he tries to explain it. I'll just read this quotation and the other quotation. The doctrine that there are no facts, but only interpretations, is termed perspectivism. To be sure, we speak of seeing the same thing from different perspectives. And we might allow that there's no way to see the thing same through a perspective. And finally, that there is no one perspective privileged over any other. These would be logical features of the concept of perspective. The only difficulty here is in talking about the same thing, on which these are distinct perspectives. Certainly we cannot say what it is except from one or another perspective, and we cannot speak about it as it is itself. We can meaningfully say nothing, then, about whatever it is on which these are perspectives. We cannot speak of a true perspective. And only of a perspective that prevails, because we cannot appeal to any fact independently of its relation to the perspective it is meant to support. And we can do little more than insist on our perspective and try, if we can, to impose it on others. So this is supposed to be a statement of Nietzsche's views. Danto tells us that early on in his book that he thinks Nietzsche didn't change his mind much as he goes along, so it doesn't really matter what books you quote in what order. So this is according to Dr. Nietzsche's view, sort of, as such, about the matter. And it's what I think is very typical of it is it starts, as a lot of the discussions of this do, and I write about, by trying to say some things about perspectives. It sounds sort of truistic, trying to list something, as it says here, or merely logical features of the concept of perspective. But at a certain point, you get a kind of mind-blowing philosophical doctrine that you are presented with that you wouldn't have thought just followed from the mere grammar of the word perspective. So something's happened, and it sort of happens really fast, like it does here. And I actually think this passage is quite confused. One of the things I hope to do by the end of today is to say enough about perspective that it starts to seem confused to you in ways that come into focus quite sharply. If it doesn't already, either just because it already does or because of reading the article. But I just give you this passage as kind of, I think, fairly representative of something that happens in writing about Nietzsche, and which was part of the proximate stimulus to my thinking about these matters and trying to get some overview of them in ways that I'll share with you now. So we'll come back to Dante. That's just by way of initial motivation. So what I'd like to do first, before we even talk about Nietzsche, is just think about the term perspective. Forgot to bring my magic mark. I think I can live without them. Do you have one? Think about the term. It takes that. It's not that important. Thank you. It's mostly a nervous habit. Whenever at the end of the class, whenever I look at the board, I realize it's a complete mess. It's probably not actually helping anybody. It's something I do while I talk. But I suppose it'll relax me. So what I want to do is talk first about the word perspective. What you might take that to stand for. Different things that has meant over the last few hundred years. And then, if you want to form something which you want to call perspectivism, because if you want to make an ism out of perspective, how do you do it? That is, what features of the concept matter? Thank you. So, we're interested in the term perspective. Maybe I'll put in quotation marks to make it clear. I mean, no word, as opposed to any particular concept. And what we're interested in is the different concepts it can signify. So there's a variety of different concepts I think we'll see this word can stand for. Some of these fairly literal uses of the term. Some of these comparatively metaphorical. Some of these are metaphorical extensions of the original term, or at this point, dead metaphors. That is, if you look it up in the dictionary, it's part of what the word means. Other than that, are still pretty metaphorical. And then, we'll be interested in what perspectivism is, which is going to depend upon which concept of a perspective you have, and which features of that concept you think are crucial for using as a philosophical analogy. It's meant to be an analogy for something like the relationship between the knowing subject and the object. And some features of how concept of perspective works, and certain features of the knowing subject, perhaps certain features of the object, which are then being analogized. But which features, as we'll see, is by no means clear. And then the next thing I want to try to bring out is how I think there's arguably something you could call the dialectic of perspectivism. A dialectic that unfolds by taking radically, or let's put this, successively metaphorical inflections of this concept and using that as the master concept out of which you want to form your perspectives and your philosophical views. So what I just said is not clear. Don't worry. I hope it's about to become clear. Again, that's just an overview of what we're about to do. In case you're feeling like these remarks aren't going somewhere, give you some confidence, maybe they are. So let's look at the first thing on the handout. These are just some truisms. I call this naive perspectivism because I'm giving you a list of things one could call perspectivism. You think any way of using the word perspective to say things about the knower and his relation to the object is a perspectivism. And I guess this is a perspectivism, a naive perspectivism. I sort of hesitate to call it that because it's not clear there's any philosophy here. And this is, I think, that's why I also say it's just a collection of truisms. It's not clear we've actually said anything of great philosophical interest. I just point out that objects look different depending upon the perspective from which they're viewed. Whatever perspective means, I think that's a feature of the content. You change it, it changes the way the thing you look at through it looks. So, one example of the way in which objects can look different is something that's round might appear elliptical. You might think from a certain position and distance, it's elliptical, and then you're like, oh no, it's not. It's actually round. Another way in which this term is used is sometimes with respect to what we might call color aspects of things. So the fact that something is green can come into view slowly as you realize that, well, it looks green, but then you realize the light's kind of yellowish here, and maybe it's actually blue. Then you take it out in the sunlight, and it is blue. So we might use the word perspective in that context to say it looks differently because of our perspective, and so on. In each of those cases, the round thing looking elliptical, the blue thing looking green, there also seems to be some conception of there being a distortion due to the conditions under which we see it. And the idea that we can correct that distortion, and indeed that we must do so if we wish to judge correctly. But still, I take this all just to be fairly truistic. Things you might say to a child in teaching him the word. It's not clear to me there's any philosophy there. But the reason I wanted this clearly truistic employment of the term to sort of stand at the beginning of the handout is to start to mark the points at which we start to move from it. The points at which we clearly are starting to broach philosophical ground. Now, what exactly when that point happens, I don't think it's so clear. I'll let you judge. I want to start very uncontroversially. So as we move from here, you can decide at what moment you want to dig in your heels. Some of you, I suspect, will dig, want to dig in your heels sort of early, and others of you will just want to keep gliding and won't feel there's reason to dig for a while. Maybe ever, but I suspect at some point each of you will want to hit the brakes. Just a question of where you think the brakes should be hit. And part I want to bring out is it's not so easy to say just what that moment is. And that topic itself is an important topic of Nietzsche's mature philosophy, I would claim, next week. Try and figure that out. First thing I want to bring up is that I'm trying to use the word in one in a way that's fairly truistic. I'm just using the word, I think, in fairly literal ways given our contemporary concept of a perspective in German and English. And though I don't know Norwegian, I bet Norwegian or Polish. It's worth noticing that even this is involves some evolution. So let's go back a few centuries to Albrecht Dürer in the beginning of modern so-called perspective pictorial representation of perspective in painting. Dürer being one of the early masters of this. And Dürer says, perspectiva is a Latin word which means seeing through. I mean, that's just literally what the two halves of the word in Latin mean. Perspectiva. To look through. And it's worth pausing over that, because if you look at the end of the Dante quotation, and what many other commentators say about what a perspective is when they're telling us that Nietzsche is a perspectivist, it looks like it belongs to the very concept of a perspective that you can't look through. You're, in a sense, stuck in it. There's this problem about the it, which the perspective is on, Dante says. So it's interesting to note that way back at the beginning, the very etymology of the word is one that involves a kind of, if you will, transparency, to borrow two other Latin words, but related meaning. And so you might ask, why did a word that originally just literally meant looking through, that's all, that's what it meant, come to mean what it means in one, where these truisms are enunciated by means of it? But it clearly means something somewhat more complicated at that point. Here it's helpful to look at Alberti's famous treatise on the art of perspective, a work that not only was codifying certain practices of painting in the Renaissance Florentine world, but itself was extremely influential treatise on painters. That is, painters read this book in order to learn how to do some of what you needed to do in order to master the craft of painting as it had developed at that point in the Italian Renaissance. Alberti has lots of things to say about this. I'm not going to go into Alberti too much. There's a bit more about it in the footnotes in the paper. But the first thing he wants to say to a painter, this is very early in the treatise on the art of perspective, the art of painting, is you have a rectangle that you can draw or you can have a canvas. First thing you need when you paint is you need a rectangle. Get yourself a rectangle. You can see this is really starting at the beginning. And then the second thing is you should treat your rectangle as an open window through which you look through at a landscape, sir. And you want to then fill in this rectangle in such a way that what the subject who looks at the rectangle sees is a similitude of what he would see if he were looking through a window at a landscape. It's a basic thought, but it's a thought that's already constitutes for someone like Alberti a critique of most previous painting. That's not what they were doing. To do this, we need ars perspectiva. We need to be able to represent the relative depths of things on a two-dimensional surface so that they actually have the appearance of depth and so on. This is a very, initial statement. So, looking through means you paint the two-dimensional canvas, which in a sense, if it were in the window, would screen what's beyond the window from view, as if you were looking through it. So the notion of looking through the canvas then becomes an instruction for a certain way of painting things on the two-dimensional surface of the canvas. So that they generate the illusion as if looking through. So that becomes then an injunction to fill out on this two-dimensional surface something that conjures up the appearance of three-dimensional relations of bodies in space. And now, with that idea of a two-dimensional representation of three-dimensional spatial relationships, you have something that starts to approximate at least the first part of what the word perspective means on the truest employment of it in one. And in quotation four, you have Panofsky explaining this. Notice how incredibly complicated this already is. We're looking at something, a canvas, which is two-dimensional, and which in a sense blocks what's behind it. And as Panofsky says, what we need to do is paint this in such a way that in a sense the canvas is negated. We don't have a sense of looking at it, but looking past it, through it, at something else. So there's both a moment of illusionism and an attempt at realism built into the concept of perspective. That's one tension at the heart of the concept. Another related tension that's built into the heart of the concept is what I call a sort of tension between a subjective and an objective moment. We might put the objective moment like this. We need to master something that already Alberti was calling a science of perspective. And the sense was that this had laws. It actually turns out to be quite a difficult science because it involves piggybacking on a number of other sciences. One science is mathematics. There's just a geometry of how as you shift a circle, it can come to be an ellipse. The whole science of conic sections that takes you from circles to ellipses of various shapes. So there's systematic, as it were, mathematical relationships between how things should vary. And then there's a science of optics. That is, how things look from various positions. And there was various techniques of representation to combine these in a way that was thought to be literally itself a science, an applied science of pictorial representation. So, for instance, one of the things the artists would do is they would place a grid over the painting, literally, a grid. Boom, 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 boom. Numbered, A, B, C, D, 1, 2, 3, 4. A chessboard with many squares. And then they would look at something, and they would have a grid here. Usually it would be made out of fabric. So a fabric grid with numbered squares. And then they would attempt to just, as it were, truncate their visual field and paint what they saw in each square, in each part of the painting, so that they could then capture the relative relationships of apparent size over space. And so, using these supposedly scientific techniques, I just gave you one example, this cloth grid, positioned in a certain kind of way. Actually, it's more complicated than that, because you also need, maybe this is worth mentioning, a fixed point. I can't just kind of stand there and look at the grid. There has to be the point at which I always go back and stand from right there and look at the grid. And I have to arrange the fixed point relative to the grid, relative to the thing that I am painting, which also has to be marked out as containing this much and no more. What is and what is not in the frame of the rectangle. And all of that has to be fixed. You're doing this with a model, it's a real pain in the ass with a model. So, no, you moved a half an inch, you know. Your elbow is no longer in square B17, it's in B16. Move again. At this point in the history of painting, life became misery for models, the way it used to be. So, all of that, I could say much more about it, but all of that is just a way of bringing up that there's an objective dimension to the science of perspective. So, a systematic set of interrelationships in what I think people are inclined to think of as the world, to which they are trying to achieve fidelity. But what's the measure of fidelity? The measure of fidelity is when I look at the painting, it looks to me as if I were looking through an open window. So the measure of fidelity is that things look right to an observer. And one of the problems is, what looks right isn't exactly what the laws of geometry or optics dictate. You had to, as they started saying very early, cheat on the laws in order to get it right. And this has been known since the beginning of art. I mean, the Greeks knew already when they were building temples. If you built the colonnade so it was geometrically perfectly spaced, and the person standing in front of the temple looked down the colonnade, thought it looked crooked. And what you want is a temple that looks right. You don't want a temple that only the architect and nobody else knows is actually built right. So you want to build the colonnade so it looks straight. In order to build the colonnade so that the distal columns appear to be in a straight line with respect to the comparatively proximate columns, you had to actually cheat on their size and position, so that you got the appearance of perfect perspective. That's just an example. There are many other examples of that. One of the things that starts happening in Alberti's day in teaching painters how to paint perspectively is teaching them how to cheat, so they have something that is apparently perfectly verisimilitudic, distinct representation of how things objectively are situated in space. So, hence I said, subjective and objective moment. Moment of illusionism, moment of realism, moment of objectivity with laws and science, moment of subjectivity, fidelity to appearance. And I think it's that tension at the heart of perspective, this is just a claim, we could spend a lot of time talking about this, but I want to move on. I think it's that tension at the heart of perspective that makes it such a fertile metaphor for philosophy. In the very beginning, philosophers see this metaphor. It's what philosophers worry about. They're worried about how to understand this rather difficult moment at which subjectivity and objectivity, reality and appearances come together. And perspective gives us something with an apparent degree of structure, which is attempting to characterize exactly that difficult moment of the entwinement of subject and object in the cognitive relation. So I think it's not accident. This just immediately becomes a metaphor philosopher sees on, and also a metaphor that starts to slip in how it's used as philosophers continue to build on it. So again, much more one could say about that. But unless someone asks me a question, I'm just going to move on slowly towards the dialectic and then towards Nietzsche. So what I have next in your handout are just, in a way, some obvious things, but things worth reminding you of, because we're going to watch them disappear before our eyes in the next hour and a half. Which is, given this original concept of a perspective, this original concept of a perspective, first of all, is an optical concept. It's a concept for the representation of visual aspects of experience. And more particularly, at least the one that I've been explaining so far, that is easy to get a really good hold of, is not just concerns the visual aspects of appearances, but it concerns the visual appearance of the spatial aspects of objects. There's much more that visually appears than merely the spatial or geometrical arrangement of things. But that's the thing that, so far, that's what this grid helps you with. This grid doesn't tell you how to vary color over space. It only tells you how to vary size over space. So now, holding all that fixed for a moment, we have these five features of that concept of a perspective. It belongs to the very idea of a perspective that you can change it. This is how things look from here. But I could move here, and then things would look a different way. And indeed, the very idea of how you're painting things is meant to bring out the fact that things look this way because you're standing here rather than there. Often what you're trying to do with perspective is make it clear what you would see if you had a more frontal view of the object, though you do not. So the idea of a perspective presupposes the idea that it is not something that is ineluctable. Indeed, one of the hard things about perspectival painting is you have to do something extremely unnatural, which is you have to mark out this fixed point, mark out the relations between everything, make sure nothing moves. And then always, what they usually had was they had a kind of board with little peephole, which they looked through the grid to make sure that they never changed their perspective in painting it. It's actually very hard to do, never change your perspective in that sense. Try it. It's a feature of human eyes, for instance, that they move. His eyes right now are moving as he looks at me. In some technical sense, from the point of view of the painter, you're actually altering your perspective. That's why you only look with one eye through a peephole. So perspectives can be altered. That was taken for granted. The second thing that's taken for granted about perspectives, very obvious, but let's say it, is that it affords a view of an object. That what a perspective is a view of an object. Now, I'm saying some things that presuppose a step that's been taken. And I wanted to just take that step and see if anyone noticed. Because I was sort of betting that no one would notice. Mm-hmm. Now let me point out that we actually took a step. In extending the concept of perspective. First, perspective meant just seeing through. Then perspective meant seeing through this canvas, pretending it's a window. Then it meant arranging things on this canvas so that it seemed that we were seeing through it. But now it means something else. It doesn't mean how things are arranged in the canvas. It means that which the arrangement of things in the canvas is itself meant to capture. When I'm talking about perspective here and I'm giving you these five features, I'm not talking about the arrangement of things on a two-dimensional surface. I'm talking about the relationship between the subject and objects in the three-dimensional world. So a perspective comes to mean something like, and it's very hard to say exactly what now, I think, but let's just cheat and pretend it's not so hard. Something like a line of sight on the object. It doesn't just mean the object. And it doesn't just mean something about me, but it means something about a particular view of the object along a line of sight. So it involves the idea both of me and the object as it appears to me, and a particular kind of relationship in which the two can stand. When I give you these features and you were nodding and it seemed fine, I was already using perspective in this way. But that's already a further step from an art of pictorial representation to this complex set of relationships to which this art of pictorial representation itself aspires to achieve fidelity. That's already a fairly, still for us, literal use of the concept of perspective. But already now quite complicated, also. Notice. Okay, so let's continue explaining that concept. Can be freely altered, it affords a view of an object. It has a specifiable location in a matrix of alternative perspectives. It belongs to having the very concept of perspective, in this sense of perspective, that if I'm looking at the object frontally and it appears round, I understand that as I alter my perspective to the left, it will appear comparatively elliptical. It will no longer appear round, and so forth. That's part of what it is to have the concept, just understand this perspective. And it makes no sense for everything in my perspective to appear equally, as it were, frontally. There are some things to which my view is oblique and some things to which my... So if I'm painting these squares, you know, the famous tile floors, some squares are nice and square, and then as you go down and as you go to the side, you start painting things that are more and more parallelograms. But that very idea involves the idea that as I shift my perspective, what is a square and what is a parallelogram in the painting of the tile floor of the palace, of the doge, or whatever, will shift. That is, this perspective stands in a certain relation to other perspectives. Wherefore, those multiple perspectives themselves are understood to be perspectives on a common object. It's the multiplicity of perspectives relative to the object which they share, which is part of what you're trying to capture and understand in mastering the art of perspective. And five, and this is part of what made a rich philosophical metaphor to begin with, there's the idea that if you have a mastery of the system of perspectives, you have a mastered a certain kind of knowledge. That once you understand the art of perspective, you can correct for distortion. Seeing the object from here, but knowing my position and my perspective, I can say what the true shape of the thing is without having to have the benefit of a perfectly frontal perspective. If it's merely shape, that's actually something you can just calculate. But if it's a matter of a metaphor, then as the metaphor works, there's an idea that perspective involves the possibility of distortion, but distortion is something you can correct for. One way you can correct for distortion is by getting a better perspective. If we're talking about, you know, this kind of perspective, we could say comparatively frontal perspective. But another way you could correct for it is by understanding the relationship between this perspective and our perspectives, and correcting for it in such a way that you understand what you would see if you did look at it from a frontal perspective. So that's all quite obvious. But the reason I bored you for almost an hour now with obvious things is because what's going to happen in the dialectic of perspectivism is that these features are going to fall away, roughly in reverse order, as the concept of a perspective becomes a philosophical metaphor in the next couple of centuries. It's an interesting thing to watch. And part of what that means is there isn't, it's not the concept of a perspective itself that's dictating what perspectivism is. There are philosophical choices to be made, even if unwittingly. But before we even see that, maybe it's worth looking at item 6 very quickly. This is Leibniz. This is one of the first people who really just totally fell in love with perspective as a metaphor for what the philosopher is doing. So, what Leibniz certainly emphasizes, which everyone else subsequently emphasizes, is that how things look depends upon the position of the cognitive subject. How things look is partly from where you look at it. That's very important, Leibniz thinks. And so on, for everyone who uses the concept of perspective. But the reason Leibniz likes the metaphor of perspective for philosophy is he thinks, yes, but what perspective shows is there's a systematic relationship, a principle, as Leibniz would put it, that governs how each of these cognitive glimpses of the object stands with respect to each other. And just like the painter can master the laws of perspective, the philosopher must master, more generally, the laws of cognitive perspective and work from how things look to us and how they look to little children and how they look to people in a different century and how it looks to the dog and how it looks to an angel, to how things are. So perspective is a metaphor for Leibniz and philosophy. But it's a metaphor that requires that all five of these features, and in particular the fifth feature, that we, though there is a difference in how things look, it's always a function of the position of the observer, we can correct for the distortion that introduces if we systematically understand how, as we vary the position from which we view things, the appearance changes. So Leibniz is the first to admit that we can never get a view ourselves of how things look that's perspective independent. But we can still work out how things really are by seeing how things vary across perspectives. So Leibniz accepts half of what any modern perspective is, even what Danto, at the end of his quotation, in which he's using the word in a very different way, says. But he draws very different conclusions. And the reason he draws very different conclusions is he's taking all five features of the concept that I listed above to be in place. And Leibniz takes this quite far. So, I mean, in his second quotation, he's talking about a certain kind of thing, which I don't know if you've ever seen. There's a great example of one in Uppsala, actually. I don't know if there's one in Norway. But there were these incredible tricks of pictorial representation where you'd look at something that seemed completely blurred and confused. But then there would be a strange kind of convex or concave mirror. It'd be a mirror sort of shaped like that. And then you'd turn around and you'd look at the painting in the mirror. And you'd have a perfect picture of, you know, the bust of Princess Sophie Charlotte, or, you know, that is what, you know. That is, it would be painted in such a way which once the distortion introduced the thing was corrected for by the distortion of, say, the concavity or convexity of the mirror, you got a perfect, if you stood in the right place, you know, representation of something that was in some sense in the painting, but if you just looked at the painting, you couldn't see it. Leibniz mentions this kind of thing at the beginning of the second part. And those devices of perspective where certain beautiful designs look like mere confusion until one restores them from the right angle. So the idea is, even where there appears to just be confusion, if you understand the principles of perspective, you can discover the order that actually lies in it. So you can see how this metaphor is operating in Leibniz's hands extremely differently. And if you go look up somebody who says he's a perspectivist now and how he's using the metaphor, he's not using it this way usually. But notice how it was first used. Now, as a kind of coming attraction, if you look at how the metaphor is being used by the end of the Danto quotation, and in the rest of the chapter, once Danto's finished that paragraph, when he's explaining Nietzsche's perspectivism, and in many versions of accounts of Nietzsche's perspectivism, the logic of the concept of a perspective as it functions as a philosophical metaphor seems to involve the following five features, which I give you in item 7, which are more or less the negation of the five features I gave you before. That is, there's this idea that perspective is something we are stuck with. So yesterday we were talking in a different seminar about some passages that Nietzsche is very impressed with, in Heinrich von Kleist and other people, who use a certain kind of analogy of spectacles to explain Kant's ideas of the forms of sensibility, the categories of understanding. But the idea is they're spectacles we cannot take off. Just like everything would appear reddish to us if we wore red spectacles, things appear spatially or causally related to us because we have these spatial or categorical mental structures. Our perspective is one of, that's how the word perspective is there used as a philosophical metaphor. But there it's a metaphor of something that cannot be freely altered, and indeed, not even not freely altered, but on some readings of this, not altered, period. Not even involuntarily altered. It's not like, you know, suddenly you get to think about things atemporally if you just get drunk enough. You just order things badly temporally if you get drunk enough. So perspective becomes something you can be confined to. We already have in the end of the Danto quotation the idea of the subject, the perspective is something you cannot see through or beyond. So what you see is dictated by your perspective, but also merely a function of your perspective. So that means, three, a perspective becomes something epistemically isolated. It's not clear what the relationship is between beings who think according to some other categories and beings who think in accordance to the category causality. There isn't anything systematic to say about this anymore. A perspective is precisely something that, in that sense, does not allow for extrapolation or transcendence. And as we also saw Danto say, once you start using the concept of perspective this way, it's very hard to keep your grip on the idea. This happens gradually in the dialectic of perspective, but eventually, by the end of the dialectic, it becomes very hard to keep your grip on the idea that there's even a common object. The perspectives are completely different, and you can't say what the relationship between the perspectives is. Then what's the sense in which you can say the perspectives are perspectives on the same thing? What's the content of same thing? And fifth, it doesn't look like there's anything that the perspective, once you make that step, that more or less entails the fifth step, which is you start to lose your grip on the idea that the perspective is a perspective on something that you can meaningfully think of as outside the perspective. At which point, we've got a concept of perspective just really different than the one we started. It's not that it's just hard to see through, or that we somehow can't see through, but it starts looking like the kind of thing that it doesn't even make sense to try to see through. But that's just, again, a coming attraction. Let's see how that happens, how these five features shift their grammar somewhat more closely in conflict. So let me start by rephrasing what I gave you in item one, those truisms. So they don't sound, in one way it's just a restatement of item one. But in another way, it doesn't sound so truistic anymore. Now it starts to sound like philosophy. So it's item eight. The world as we experience it appears to have contradictory qualities. A coin appears round when viewed from here, elliptical when viewed from there. The mountain appears green and this light blue in that light. But these are not necessarily intrinsic properties of the world. But they rather be perspective-dependent properties of it. That is, they may not necessarily be properties of the objects we perceive as those objects are in themselves. Rather, they may just be relative to some point of view or set of standing conditions under which the objects of experience are encountered. I think this certainly sounds more philosophical than the first thing I have. If you give the first thing, it looks like someone's talking to a child. If you give the second one, it sounds like you're quoting a philosophy text. But what's the difference between them? I don't think it's clear. As the second thing could just be taken to be a rephrasing of the first thing in fancier language. It's just a fancier way of deploying the same truisms. Or, depending upon how you flesh out or understand or what kind of weight you put on some of the words I italicized there, contradictory qualities, intrinsic properties, perspectival properties, or perspective-dependent properties, the way the objects are themselves. You start fleshing any one or all of those ideas out in a certain way, then you're clearly going to be going into something that is involving substantive philosophical commitments. And I think that's what happens. So the dialectic of perspectivism starts with recapturing the truisms in something like this form, and then starting to put weight on these notions in a particular way. The idea of intrinsic and perspective-dependent property. And that brings us to what I'm going to call stage one. I'm going to distinguish four stages of the dialectic of perspectivism. I'm not saying, when I distinguish these four stages, I'm not saying you could, for various reasons, make this more than four stages or less than four stages. My reason for distinguishing these four stages is I think it helps give us a good chart in which to position Nietzsche's thought, his own thought, and both his thought about the previous history of philosophy. It's a bit complicated, but I try not to make it more complicated than it has to be. So it's a minimal level of helpful complexity. Yes?
Yes, and just about just the wording.
Yes, okay.
And you said that he's are not necessarily intrinsic properties of the world. Do you mean of isolated objects as vocals, or do you mean the world as such?
Well, I purposely wanted to be completely unclear. What is that? What I tried to make clear is this looks like a rephrasing of the other statement, which doesn't even invite that kind of question, I think. You know, the other statement was just stuff like, you know, something looks, you know, green in one light, it can look blue in another. And you're not as inclined to ask, what do you mean by something? but now when we rephrase it, it invites that kind of question. Exactly. And then how you answer that question is going to be what's going to land you in stage one or stage two or stage three. So that, you're asking exactly the right question. But the question is, what do you want to mean by that? And depending upon how you answer that, I think that partly fixes the grammar of how the metaphor is being used, and that's what perspectivism comes out to be. So if we look at stage one, we'll see they have a certain answer to your question. But I'm not saying that's what this means. I'm saying, here's some words, and trying to figure out what these means is what causes this. And stage one is one way of opting for some quite determined answer. Stage two, which grows out of stage one, changes the answer to your question, I think, and so forth. So I precisely want this to invite your question. But it would precisely sort of beg my purpose in trying to show you how this issues in a dialectic of a certain sort of say. And this is what those words must mean. I guess I think it's not clear what those words can mean, any of many different things. That's what, you know, it's not, there isn't, you know, if we had a good enough microscope and we could get, you know, a really good view of these words in a page, that's not going to answer the question. The question is what you do with the words, how do you use them, is what's going to determine what they mean.
The distinction between primary and secondary qualities serve as an example of...
That's just what I said. Yeah, that's what stage one is.
Yeah.
Stage one I call primary quality realism. Mm-hmm. That's one way of giving the answer. But I don't want to be suggesting, and that's what you must mean. But I think it's interesting just notice how, in rephrasing item one, with this philosophically weightier vocabulary of item eight, your question then becomes invited in a way in which you're just yawning when you read it.
I was feeling that if we should use the broad expression world here, it would seem to me like there's an implicit ontological dualism in the argument, and that my thoughts or my perceptions are some way or another separated from the world. But
once you start using words like that, I agree, philosophers will hear it that way. That's why I didn't use a word like world in item one. But once you use world and appearance, you could just take it to be a restatement of item one. Or you could start thinking, now I need an account of what the world is, what its unity is, and what are mere appearances. That's exactly what you get a first version of with stage one. Notice that doesn't come from the concept perspective alone. When I was first talking about painting, that didn't happen. But it comes from a certain way of phrasing what a perspective is, and then trying to use it as a metaphor. And even then, it doesn't dictate the result. So what I propose we do is take a 5-minute break, and then we will start to look at an answer to your question, namely stage one.